So I was talking to Ben right after his Bible study this morning, and I wanted to thank him because it seems like almost every single message is blending into the next one. And what Ben was speaking of today fits right into what I was going to talk about. In fact, it meshes very well. I'll find out how good your memory was or is. One of the scriptures that he used, I'm going to be using today. So we'll see if those of you who are at the Bible study recognize it. So for those of us or you out there that are our friends and know what we do, our family were contractors, licensed plumbers, HVAC. We do plumbing, heating, and refrigeration. And the reason I'm telling you that, because I want to tell you what happened to me not that long ago. I had a call, and the call was really simple. This lady and her husband wanted to do an addition onto their house, the side of their house. And so she called up and she says, "I would like a quote for this addition." And so I show up, and she takes me over to their side of the house, and her husband are, "This is what we want. We want a price." And so the first question I asked her was, "Do you have a set of plans or drawing or anything?" No. "We just want a price to add a bathroom, do a bedroom. We need heat and AC out there." I'm like, okay. It doesn't kind of really work that way. In order for me to give you a price, you have to define your terms. I have to know what I'm bidding or what I'm giving your price on. I need some sort of drawing. Like, I asked her a question. I said, "How many square foot?" "We don't know." "What about the fixtures? Am I supplying the fixtures or are you?" I mean, some people buy them at Home Depot. "We haven't thought about that." So the reason I'm bringing this up is, in construction, the most important thing when it comes to a building of any kind, whether it's a building, a house, you have to have a good set of plans, a blueprint. Otherwise, none of us contractors will have a clue what is expected out of us. And so I kind of explained that to her, and I said, "Well, you guys need to sit down with an architect or someone to come up with a set of drawings so I know exactly where the placement of everything is going to be, from the toilet, the tub, what kind of heat you want." "What kind of heat do you want?" "We don't know. We just want heat." So it makes it very, very difficult, in fact, almost impossible, for you to do any kind of a building project without a set of plans. My father-in-law, Richard Gray, he's actually there in a fee site in Colorado. He mentioned something interesting. He said, "The Old Testament is a blueprint. The New Testament is the actual building project. You cannot, it is an utter impossibility for them to build this building without a step-by-step project blueprint, specs that tells you exactly how they're going to do the footer, the foundation, what kind of walls, what kind of materials go into it. It's critical. It's critical. And our Creator did not put us on this earth without a set of blueprints, without a blueprint. And when it comes to construction, everything, and I mean everything, must be done in a logical order, in a planned out set of sequence of events. For instance, if you don't put the walls up until you have a foundation, you can't, when you put the walls up, you don't call the guy into sheetrock until the plumbing's in the wall and the electrical's in the wall. All of this has to be organized. And it has to be run by a person that's pretty competent. in the field in construction, we call that guy the supervisor or the contractor. And we call him super for short. So if I show up on a job site and it's a new build and I have a question, I would try to find the super because he has the master set of plans, and he has taken the plans and he has put them in his mind and gone over them and over them. And so everything is running like clockwork. And so that it's really, really important that you have a super, kind of a master builder. And a lot of times they have to be licensed. In the state of Colorado, you can't go to the building department and wanting to get a permit without a stamped set of plans that they review before you even get the permit. And so there's a sequence of events that have to happen even before you break ground. This has to happen. So it's good to have a good contractor. It's important because they understand the sequence of events. It doesn't matter how fast the homeowner wants to get the job done. You cannot start your framing or anything until the concrete has cured. You cannot do this until this happens, until then you bring in this person. I'm a plumber, and I have gone to job sites to put my plumbing in, and they had called in the electrician first. And I'm trying to run all of these plumbing lines, and they have to have a grade. There's all these wires in the way. And so there's a sequence of things that have to happen before they call in the next guy. And this is the true story. It was going to be on a Monday. I was scheduled to go up in the attic and put all of the ductwork in for this new build. I show up on a Monday morning, and because the contractor was a bad contractor, he wasn't very good. It was such a hurry, he called in the insulators. And they blew in the insulation up in the attic. I'm talking 20, 24 inches of cellulose, okay? So I get up there Monday morning, I get the ladder up, and I pop the thing, and I'm ready to go. And I look up in the attic, and I'm like, so I called the guy, and I said, what do you want me to do? Do you want me to swim through all of the insulation to put in the ductwork? So my life experiences in the construction my whole life, my dad was a plumber, HVAC guy, is the timing and sequence of events. Otherwise, nothing's going to work out. It doesn't. So when you're choosing a super, that we would call him, he needs to be qualified and experienced to get the job done correctly. He takes care of the details that you wouldn't even think of. And he needs to have past experience. I would never, looking for a contractor to be over my project, get a guy that is green or he's never built anything in his life. It's not going to go well. So I'm going to tell you something else that happened to me. I had a call. And this client I'd done a lot of work for, this lady and her husband. And I was working on her boiler. Her heat wasn't working. And I like to explain things. I'm a dad. I have 5 children. I like to explain things. And so I was diagnosing the problem why the boiler wasn't working. And so I went to grab her and her husband, and I brought them into the garage where the boiler was, and I proceeded to tell them what was wrong and how I was going to fix it. And I started in. Well, this is the pump, and this is this. This is what it does, and this is reason it's not firing is because of this, and blah, 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 blah. She did something. She held her hand up like this, and she said, look, I completely trust you. Just do what needs to be done. And she walked away. That floored me. It floored me. Because I was ready to give her all the explanation of why I was doing what I was doing and how I was going to fix and everything. it floored me because I had to pause for a second. It struck me in such a different way. So I have always struggled my whole life about what the definition of faith is, truly, what true faith is. So I looked it up in the Wikipedia, and faith is confidence or trust in a person, thing, or concept. Okay, so I had done work for this lady before, so what she was basically saying, look, I have faith in you. Based upon past experiences, your license, I have four different licenses actually. Based upon your being licensed contractor, we have had nothing but good experience with you. You know what you're doing. Say no more. You don't need to tell me all the details. And so the reason that struck me kind of, it rattled me, is because there's been times in my life when I was like, well, people say that you should have faith and then it will happen. You just need to have faith. I'll tell you a true story. We have a neighbor. We have cows. We have a farm. We have cows, goats, chickens, turkeys. We have a neighbor that lives up on the hill. She's kind of a Pentecostal lady. And our cow, one of our cows was pregnant, one of our younger heifers. We really wanted the cow to have a little heifer calf, a little female calf, instead of a bull, because we can raise that one up and it can breed that one and it can have more cows and our herd expands. We didn't want a bull, a little baby bull. We wanted a heifer. Well, the lady was there, and she's one of the types that is, you just have to believe. Just believe and it will happen. So I'm going to pray that you're going to have a little heifer calf. And if you believe with all your heart and you believe strongly enough, you'll get your heifer calf. And we're like, okay. And lo and behold, out pops a bull calf. So these kind of things throughout my history in my life have not caused me to question what faith is, but to question myself is, what is wrong with me? Do I just not have enough faith that we would have a heifer calf? But I am learning, especially in construction, that when you have a job site and you want everything to run smoothly, you have to put your trust in the super that he has your back. He's going to keep things happening in a logical order. The idea of faith is, and trust are not a warm, fuzzy feeling. Now, the lady that I fixed her boiler, or I was going to, when she told me, look, I trust in you, she didn't close her eyes and rebuke the boiler and say, you know, in the name of Jesus, I command you to be fixed. She didn't have the understanding how to fix it herself. She had trust in me based upon facts that, one, I was experienced. Two, I had the knowledge of how to do it. And in a way that helps me to understand our God and what really, truly faith is. Faith is not that God will do what we think he will do. Faith is that he will do what is best. She said, just take care of it. Fix a boiler. I trust you. So I'm coming in my life, I'm coming to understand more and more actually what trust and faith is. It's based upon facts. Hebrews 11, verse 6, if you don't mind turning there. Hebrews 11, verse 6. But without faith, it is impossible to please him. For he who comes to him, comes to God, must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. How would you know that God is a rewarder? How do you know he rewards people that seek him? It's past experience, actually. It's right there in front of you, or maybe in your lap. There's books and chapters and verses that God has established and given to us, history of past experiences of how he has always 100% kept his word, and that he has the knowledge of how to take care of any kind of problems that we have. So, did I have the faith that we were going to have a heifer calf? No. Do I have faith that my God has my best interest at heart? Yes. That I can have faith in. If you need to find a job and you've been looking, and someone would come up to you and say, you just have to have faith that you'll get a job tomorrow. Do you have that faith? I would have to say, no. But I do have faith in my awesome God, the great master builder, and who has all a sequence of events established, and he knows exactly what he's doing. That I can have faith in. There's a difference. Faith is not a warm, fuzzy feeling that comes from down here and comes up when you close your eyes and it's just, you get this warm, fuzzy feeling all over it. That's not what it is. It's based upon facts. I'm going to prove it. If you look in Luke chapter 8 or 17, Luke chapter 17, verse 18, this is the interesting thing that happened with Yeshua, Jesus. Luke 17, verse 18. It says, then the disciples of John reported to him concerning all these things, and John, calling two of his disciples to him, sent them to Jesus, saying, are you the coming one, or do we look for another? Basically, he sent two of his disciples and said, are you the Messiah, or are we waiting for someone else? When the men had come to him, they said, John the Baptist has sent us to you, saying, are you coming? Are you the coming one, or do we look for another? And that very hour, which is interesting, this little verse 21 just kind of stuck in here. In that very hour, he cured many of infirmities, afflictions, and evil spirits, and to many blind he gave sight. So watch this. Jesus, Yeshua, answered and said to them, of course I'm the Messiah. Go tell John I'm the Messiah. That's it. Just got to believe. He didn't say that. He said, go and tell John the things that you have seen and heard, that the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, the poor have the gospel preached to them, and blessed is he who is not offended because of me. God does not ask us to have blind faith based on nothing. Faith is based upon what you have seen and heard. Now, God didn't just show, Yeshua, 2,000 years ago, didn't just show up and say, hey, I'm the Messiah. Here I am. A systematic stage of events has been going on. They prophesied of what Messiah was to be, how he was to live his life, how he was to die to the very detail, Psalm 22, and on and on and on and on. And so, I can have faith in that because God says it's impossible for him to lie. He says, what have you seen? And I would have to say that the same thing with anything in your life when you're like, I should have faith. Faith is based upon what you know and what you actually can wrap your mind around. It's past experiences and it's trust in a being that has never, never been wrong. That I can have faith in. Another example is Peter walking on the water, Matthew chapter 14, verse 22. If you don't mind turning there. It's really dry, sorry. Matthew chapter 14, verse 22. So immediately Jesus, Yeshua, made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side. When he sent the multitudes away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. Now, when evening came, he was alone there. But the boat was now in the middle of the sea, tossed by the waves, for the wind was contrary. Now, in the fourth watch of the night, Yeshua, Jesus, went to them walking on the sea. And when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were troubled, saying, "It is a ghost," and they cried out for fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Be of good cheer, it's I, do not be afraid." And watch this. Peter answered him and said, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." And so he said, "Come." Now, Peter didn't ask his God, "Just give me the faith that I can walk on water," or "give me the ability to walk on water." He asked his God to command me to come to you. When God commands something, you can have 100% faith in that. And you know what happened? Peter gets out of the boat, starts walking across the water because his God told him to come. Peter didn't have the ability to walk on water. Neither did he have the faith in himself to walk on water. His creator told him to come. So he said, "Come." And when Peter had come down out of the boat, he walked on the water to go to Jesus, Yeshua. And when he saw that the wind was boisterous, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, saying, "Lord, save me." And immediately Yeshua stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" So I questioned myself, well, what was this doubt? What was he doubting? Was he doubting his ability to walk on the water? Or was he he just saw the waves and he doubted and he forgot that his God just told him to come to him? So faith is not a warm, fuzzy feeling. He gave a command. And when our God says, "Do something," you can have 100% faith in that. The rest of it, I don't. If I told you, "I have faith that you are going to win the lottery tomorrow," do you believe? All you got to do is just believe. What do you think? I would say, no, probably not going to win the lottery tomorrow. One, my God, the great master builder, probably knows that that would not be in the best interest of the building project that he has going on. And so the answer would be no. And Yeshua says, and they ask him how we should pray. He says, when you pray this, "Your will be done." We don't pray that our will is done. God is not a puppet. He's not a puppet on a string that I can manipulate him around to do my will. Yeshua says, pray that your will would be done. James chapter 4, verse 2. James chapter 4, verse 2 says, "You lust and you do not have. You murder and covet and cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you do not have because you do not ask. You ask and do not receive because you ask amiss that you may spend it on your pleasures." And so faith should be focused on his will, what he wants for you. You know, Yahweh, or God, he brought Israel out of Egypt with a mighty hand. There's plagues against Egypt, the death of the firstborn. He split the Red Sea. All these wonderful miracles that he did right in the very sight of Israel. And he brings them to the Jordan to cross into the promised land, and they had no faith. And so you would be going, what is wrong with these people? Why? He had just shown them all of his power and might. They didn't trust him for some reason when he'd already established that he was trustworthy and he had the power to do what he needed to do, to protect them. But they for some reason, they didn't trust. So trust is critical on a job site. We have to trust in the set of plans that we have. Mainly we trust in, not the set of plans, but we trust in the supervisor who's going to be overseeing these plans. So there's a scripture that I like to read. It's ironically It has both faith and a building project all kind of combined in one. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called. This is Hebrews chapter 11, verse 8. Hebrews 11, verse 8. By faith, Abraham obeyed when he was called to go out to the place which he would receive as an inheritance. He went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he dwelt in the land of promise as in a foreign country, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, the heirs with him of the same promise. For he waited for the city which has foundation, whose builder and maker is Yahweh, God. So our God is actually a master builder. He has a building. He has a building project that he is working on and has been for almost 6,000 years. And you are that building project. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 1 says, I can just read it, 1 Peter 2, 1. Therefore, laying aside all malice and all deceit, hypocrisy, envy, and all evil speaking, as newborn babes, desire the pure milk of the word, that you may grow thereby, if indeed you have tasted that the Lord is gracious. Coming to him as to a living stone, rejected indeed by men, but chosen by God and precious, you also, as living stones, are being built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Messiah Yeshua, Jesus Christ. In 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 9, we are God's fellow workers. You are God's field. You are God's building. There's a building project underway. We are that. I can relate to that as a contractor. And I can definitely appreciate a good set of plans. I can appreciate a master builder who has every detailed orchestrated and keeping track of. You know, interestingly, too, on a lot of the bigger jobs that I was on, the master builder sometimes would have a helper or a guy, kind of a go-to guy, that if I had a question or so, he was almost always on site, almost always there every day, that I could go to, and if he couldn't, then I would go to, couldn't answer the question. I feel like that is the Holy Spirit. I feel like God is our master builder, and his Holy Spirit is there helping us to understand, guiding us on this whole building project as we're being built up into a spiritual house. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 19 says, now therefore you are no longer strangers and foreigners, but fellow citizens with the saints and members of the household of God, having been built on the foundation of the apostles and prophets, Jesus Christ, Yeshua, Messiah, himself being the chief cornerstone, in whom the whole building, being fit together, grows into a holy temple in the Lord. In whom you also are being built together for a dwelling place of God and the Spirit. So we are that building project. So our super, as we would call him in the field, he's scheduling meetings like today. He's picking out building supplies. And he's even planned out it all at the proper time. I like diversity. I do like it when I drive around and I see different shaped houses and different. I don't like cookie cutter houses at all. I like the diversity. Diversity is. Did you know that's a godly thing? Is diversity? Just look around you. A snowflake. They say that there is no two snowflakes alike. And there's, I don't know, a gazillion of them when it snows. Here's what's really interesting. There's no two snowflakes alike. Do you know what snow is made out of, snowflakes? They're made out of mostly water, which we are. We're mostly water, with a little dirt particle. And the other interesting thing about snowflakes is every single one has 6 points on it. Man's number is six. So I think, and also when you have enough of them together, they're white, right? Snow's white. So I like types that are in creation. So snowflakes to me represent you. If you look across at the person at your table, nobody looks just like you. All of you are individually different in some way. You're never going to run across a same person like you ever in this creation. I think that's why snowflakes are. No two people are alike. So here's an interesting thing that happened. God, he, after Noah and the flood, God instructed Noah to go out from the ark. This is after everybody was killed except for the eight people in the ark. And God told Noah something. He said he wanted him to go out, multiply, and fill the earth. But shortly thereafter, what did man do? Genesis chapter 11, verse 3. We'll read about it. 11, verse 3. Then they said to one another, come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly. So let us make bricks. They had brick for stone and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. I'll tell you something interesting about bricks. I looked up this word for bricks. It is Strong's number 3843. It means white clay. So bricks are made in molds. They're all the same shape and size. When they make bricks, they go in a mold. Clay goes in. And so they're all identical. They're all the same. And asphalt and mortar come from the Greek word from Strong's 2560. You know what it means? It means ferment or bubble up. It means leavening. So, which is interesting. Here you have white clay, which typically white means righteousness, right? But you have something that binds these bricks that these guys were making at the Tower of Babel, held together by something that represents sin. So they have the appearance of righteousness because the Tower of Babel was a religious system. It was a religious system. So the system that they were attempting to create had the appearance of righteousness, but it's because of its religious aspect, it was being held together by sin. You'll notice something. God never uses bricks to build. Show me one place where he ever uses bricks to build anything. He uses stones. Stones. You're never going to find two stones that are exactly alike. But what mankind was attempting to do is by doing bricks, it's almost like socialism or communism. They're all little cookie cutters. They're all the same. But when God uses stones, which we are, as in Yeshua is the chief cornerstone, it says in 1 Peter 2:1, I read it, we are living stones being tightly fit together, okay? The bricks that they were wanting to form represent man. Because you know what man is made out of? Clay. They would use clay and water, and what would hold this together was a word that means leavening. Sin. Possible. I like types. So the idea of totalitarianism is, that's a hard word for me to say, I'm from Texas. Totalitarianism is to make everyone the same by taking away their individuality. That way people are easier to control. So here at the Tower of Babel, of course, they gathered everybody up. They wanted to make a name for themselves. And the first thing they start doing, they start firing off these bricks and they're all the same, same shape. If you get rid of the individuality of people, they're easy to control. You know, I've really appreciated a lot of the messages we've heard about that you don't go into Babylon to find out how to worship God. And you don't mix things from Babylon with the Almighty. They don't cohabitate. Like I said, show me anywhere where a God has ever used bricks to make anything. Totalitarianism seeks to control all media, education, and speech. And we see that today. Do they not? They want to control you. You have political correctness. This is pushed by the government, its courts, its education system, the media. What they eventually want to do is erase all freedom of speech and the thoughts from the minds of the people. This Babylonian system. Socialism is the utopian promise of equality for the people, but it is the opposite of liberty. Think about that. And the goal of the communist, socialist, fascist regimes is to make people dependent upon the government for everything, and therefore they become slaves of their own government. That's why it was written in Revelation chapter 17, verse 5. It says, "And on her forehead a name was written, Mystery Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and abominations of the earth." There is a mark that is coming, part of this Babylonian system that we must not take, we must not be a part of. The reason that they wanted to build, put these bricks together and fire them off and build a city was they were in direct rebellion against the Most High. They were in rebellion. These people that want this socialist communist society, these people are the brick makers. They are going to form us into these little cookie cutters. Have you guys ever seen the parades that they have in China? And all the little people on their same, and they're all wearing the same thing, and they're just, that's cookie cutters. You know, when I look out here in the audience, what I love about this is none of you guys are wearing the same thing. You don't look the same. I love diversity. Satan does not. Diversity is the way that our God is. Look at everything. Even, like I said, look at the snowflake. So man makes bricks, and God makes stones. So there's actually two building projects underway right now. One is by Yahweh, and the other is by Satan. And they're a direct opposition to each other. He says something in Exodus, which is really interesting to me. In Exodus chapter 20, verse 25. Exodus chapter 20, verse 25. And this is when Yahweh was telling them how they were supposed to build these altars and so forth. "And if you make me an altar of stone, you shall not build it of hewn stone, for if you use your tool on it, you have profaned it." Why would he say that? The stones represent God's people, and if we allow man to shape us, then we become polluted through the false teachings of men, and we are unfit for God's use. God says, if you are chiseling away on that, you can't use it. It has to be basically of you cannot, they have to be, they can't be hewn stone. They have to, you don't build it with hewn stone, okay? God is not interested in cookie cutters. He is the one that is picking out the different individual stones that fit perfectly together, but this is by his doing. He doesn't want man to do it. He told him, don't you do it. You can't use it. So what did God do? So in Genesis chapter 11, verse 5, "But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they all have one language. And this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord, Yahweh, scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building the city. Therefore, its name is called Babel, because the Lord confused the language of the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth." So making these bricks was a pretty quick way to get a building project going up. It's definitely faster than finding stones fitly that fit tightly together. That would take a while. It takes time. This pyramid shape, this is what they call a ziggurat or ziggurat. Yeah, ziggurats, I guess. Ziggurats. If one of you has a dollar bill in your pocket, and if you flip it over and look at it, that same sign or that same shape is there. So the ziggurats, to me, is a symbol of the Babylonian religious political system. And it was carried throughout the whole world after God scattered the people from the Tower of Babel. You know, they find Mayan ziggurats today. They uncover them. And you know what's really prominent on the ziggurats that they find? Serpents. Why snakes? Why is snakes such a big thing with these? Well, that goes back to the beginning, to the serpent in the garden. This building structure is not of Yahweh. And one thing that you'll notice is, which is really, really fascinating to me, is God does not rule from the top of a pagan pyramid. The driving force behind the building of the original Tower of Babel was rebellion against God. And it, along with it was a commitment to worship Satan. Certainly the worldwide people, the people in the world, they worship Satan, a lot of them not knowing it. So the question would be, if the Babylonian system is a pyramid, well, what shape would God's system be? Let's find out. Let the Bible interpret itself. In Exodus chapter 25, verse 8, Exodus 25, verse 8, it says, "And let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell among them, according to all that I show you, that is, the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of all its furnishings, just so shall you make it." So he gave Moses the blueprint, exactly how he was supposed to do it. And you'll notice something interesting. Yahweh says that he may dwell among them, in the midst of them. He never said that I may dwell on the top of them, as in a hierarchy. Yahweh, God, dwells in the midst of his people. If you look at the way that he placed the tabernacle in the wilderness, it was in the very center, and you had the three different tribes surrounding it, with God in the middle. But a Babylonian system is a hierarchy. It's a hard word. It's a hierarchical system where you have up here, and then you have the, even in a lot of the churches are set up that way. You have the Pope, and you have the bishops, and then this, and this, and this. And then you have the lay people are down here at the bottom. That's kind of a pyramid shape of system. But ironically, that's not the way that our God had in mind. He dwelled among us, and he was positioned in the middle of them. And in the tabernacle, in the Holy of Holies, the shape is a cube. It's a cube. And here's some interesting things. If I had a cube and I set it up here on the counter or up here on the podium and you were looking at it, the cube has six sides to it. Six is the number of man. And it has eight corners. There's eight corners on the cube. Eight is the number of new beginnings. And if you look at the edges, if you count up all the edges, it has 12. That's Israel's number. I love types. So, and I don't believe in coincidences. So numbers have meaning. And so if you look at the way that he told them to make it, the Holy of Holies was to be 10 cubits cubed, basically. 10 cubits cubed. It's a cube. So there's another thing that it mentions too about the Tower of Babel. It says, by the heavens, they probably mean what it says. It says, and they were building this building to reach up into the heavens, it says. Probably what they were talking about maybe is the maybe upper atmosphere. Don't know exactly how big and tall this building was. I would guess it's probably this similar to the heights of the buildings that we have today. Like the one in Dubai, the highest, tallest building in the world is 162 stories. And it's a height of about 2,717 feet, or just over one half of a mile high. That's the largest building that there is in Dubai. Don't know how high it was. But the principle there, it was in rebellion against God. Mankind wants to elevate themselves. That's why they would build such a building. No matter how high they climbed, it seems that the Lord still, which is ironic, this is such an irony is here, it says that the Lord still had to descend to view their human enterprise. So it doesn't matter how tall their building was, our God still had to come down to their level and descend. Think about that. It clearly shows that how lofty that our God is above whatever mankind could possibly do. It says he descended down. I thought that was kind of interesting. You know, there are a lot of people think that God does not intervene in human history. He does. I've been on a job site where I was there working, and there were other contractors working, maybe as electricians or something, and where the super would come in, and I can hear him say, no, nope, that's not what the plans say. You're doing it wrong. Do it this way. And so that's what happened here at the Tower of Babel. The master builder, Saul, didn't like what he saw was going on. And he came down, and he's going to mix some things up with that. Now, the whole earth spoke only one language. That makes sense, doesn't it? God created Adam and Eve. They had a language. They were speaking some kind of language. I think it possibly was the original Hebrew. That's just my opinion. But here's the interesting thing. Whatever language that God gave Adam and Eve was passed down from generation to generation. There was no new languages that were developed because it said everyone could understand everyone. It said basically they all spoke one language. That was originally God's plan for mankind. But as a result of this new rebellion of them disobeying God, their refusal to scatter and fill the earth, God was going to change the language situation in a big way. Here's what we miss. This is what we read over and we completely miss it. What God did was not simply give the people of Shinar many new languages. Let's say that there were 100,000 people, or however many people there were. And let's say that he gave them 25 different languages to speak, okay? But that's only half of what he did. It's only half. If that is all that he did, they could still all communicate with the first language that they've been speaking for all those years. He did something. He took away their first language because it says they did not understand each other. And we kind of miss over that. They've been speaking this language everybody knew, and now all of a sudden everything's confusing. So that's the second part of it, is you took away the first language. This had never happened before, and this was very confusing to people. So you can imagine what that must have looked like. Let's say that you, like me, only speak English. Now imagine one day you lose the ability to speak English, and you now only speak Chinese, okay? And the people on the next table over there, they no longer speak English nor understand it. They only speak Arabic. And then this table over here no longer speaks English. See, if it was just adding 25 different languages, then you would just revert back to the one, oh, we already know how to speak English or Hebrew or whatever it was. He took away the first one. But what would happen? What would happen is the people, the different tables that had a specific language, say Chinese, you people would all get together and you would, because you really can't communicate with these people. You can't even understand anything they're saying. You would gather your little people and you would go off into this part of the world. And you people would gather your little tribe and language and you would go off and spread them. So what God did was actually a very wise way of breaking things up. Either way, God caused them to do what he wanted. So this battle is between man's will and God's will. They were going to do it his way because he is the master builder. And you know what? On a job site, the super that we call him has the ability to run you off the job. I've seen it happen. I've seen him walk up and say, you know what? Get off my job. He has that kind of power because he is hired by the owners of the property on this building project. I've seen it. He didn't like it. They weren't listening to him, and he had the authority off. So God did not like what he saw with the Tower of Babel. Did you know that in the future, it is his plan to restore a pure language? Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 9. Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 9. For then I will restore to the peoples a pure language, that they all may call on the name of Yahweh, to serve him with one accord. So the problem wasn't that the people were of one accord and together. The problem was they were in rebellion to the Most High. That's why he had to divide the language up. Who knows how long it was of a period of time. They all had one language on the earth, and everything was just fine. Probably was the same language that God gave Adam and Eve. Most likely. So, in the construction field, we have a saying. And the saying is like this. The faster you want it, the worse you're going to get it. The faster you want it, the worse you're going to get it. It seems to me, in my experience, the faster that people try to hurry things along on a job site, the worse it turns out. I'll give you an example. I had a homeowner that was acting as their own super, their own contractor. They were trying to save money. So now we're going to be the supervisor. Okay, they have no experience. And so they call me up and they're like, hey, when can you come here? I need you to set the toilet and the lavatories and the sinks and everything. I need you here. I'm like, okay, we plan on Monday or whatever. And I would show up. And they hadn't tape and textured the walls. The flooring wasn't even down. And I explained to them, ma'am, sir, you don't set the toilet until after the flooring's down because you kind of want the flooring to be under the toilet. And you can't paint the walls and tape and texture and all of the sanding and everything when you have a toilet in the way. Or are you just going to leave behind the wall just sheetrock behind the toilet? So there is a certain step-by-step-by-step set of events that has to happen. So having a good super makes all the difference in the world. It's a timing thing. You can't get one thing ahead of the other. It doesn't work. God's timing often differs from human expectations. God's timing is not your timing. I am learning that. When I was younger, I wanted everything to hurry up. Couldn't wait till I was old enough to drive. Wanted to get married and start a family. Did you know that you can get married in 30 minutes? But it takes years to have a good marriage. That's just human nature. We want everything right now. The best things in life I have learned is they take time. Ecclesiastes chapter 3, verse 1. To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven. Now, I'm not a huge sports person, but I have played baseball. And I know that in baseball, to hit the ball requires exact timing. And your mind does it very fast. I don't know how, praise Yahweh, where by the time that ball leaves the pitcher and comes across the plate, you have known the perfect timing of when to swing the bat to strike that ball right across the plate. Timing is everything. And that was the title of my message today, was timing is essential. And it really is. With everything. I'm finding that to be the true with construction, with marriage, everything. The baker, a person who's cooking, the baker has to know when to pull the cake out, otherwise it is going to be too dry. They leave it in. Timing is everything. It's not can you read music, but can you keep time? I know some people that have no musical timing whatsoever. I won't mention names. But if you ask them to keep a beat, you know, but some people have it down, like some people have the timing of music down to a T. You can be right about what you said, but you can be wrong when you said it and do more damage than you did good. Timing is everything. Right information delivered at the wrong time can destroy relationships. Or it can cause a child to feel defeated. Timing is everything. Did you know that on a job site, if you order a load of concrete and the guy shows up and you're not ready for it, you know what they do? They dump it right there on the job site, off to the side, and they charge you for it. So when it comes to concrete, which I've done quite a bit, I don't like doing it because, boy, you got to work it fast and you got to be ready for it. So timing is everything on a job site when it comes to a building. And I am learning in my life that we need to rely on the timing of our Creator with this building project right here. You may want to get married. It may not be the right time. Maybe God has somebody in store for you. But if you hurry and try to rush things up and you order that concrete and you're not ready for it, it's just going to be a big mess. Try to clean up a whole truckload of concrete on a job site as it hardens into this big mountain of rock. God's timing is rarely our timing. It could be one of the reasons why the most frequent cries in Psalms is, "How long, O Lord? How long?" Psalm 13, verse 1. "How long, O Lord, will you forgive me forever? How long will you hide your face from me? How long shall I take counsel in my soul, having sorrow in my heart daily? How long will my enemies be exalted over me?" And in Psalms chapter 6, verse 3, "My soul also is greatly troubled, but you, O Lord, how long?" That's human nature. How long? We want things right now. We human beings, we want everything now. We don't like waiting. When you go through the drive-thru, you want your food in 3 minutes. Don't like to wait. Do you know what the credit card debt is? People want to buy now and pay later. Credit card debt in America just hit $1.14 trillion this last quarter. $1.14 trillion. The average interest rate on the credit card right now is 22.76%. So why is the credit card why is Americans so up to their eyeballs in credit? You know why? Because they want it now and they want to pay for it later. The idea of waiting is not, it's against human nature. We want it now. I want it now. This is not a new concept. Did you know that Satan was trying to use this concept on Messiah? He tried to trick Messiah. In Matthew 4, verse 8, again, the devil took him up, Yeshua, Jesus, on an exceedingly high mountain, and he showed him all the kingdoms of the world in their glory, and he said, all these things I will give you. I will give you all of this if you'll just fall down now and worship me. Now, here's a thing to keep in mind. Yeshua, he wants to rule. He wants his bride. He wants that very bad. But he's having to wait. And so what Satan knows the truth. Satan was appealing to him, to Yeshua. Look, I will give this to you right now. All you got to do is just bow down and worship me, and it's yours. What was he appealing to? He was appealing to that part of the human nature, is I want it right now. I don't want to wait. And Yeshua, wow, so much wisdom, because he was the Word. And Yeshua said to him, away with you, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. So then the devil left him, and behold, angels came to him and ministered to him. What Satan was offering Yeshua, Jesus, was the chance to not wait, a chance to have it now. But our master craftsman, our general contractor, our master supervisor with this building project, he knows the value of the right timing and sequence of events. He knows it. He knows that patience is indeed a virtue. So in Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 8, the ending of a thing is better than the beginning. The patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. So I'm going to ask a question to everybody here, okay? If you had a chance at having things tomorrow, but of a lesser quality, or having things next week at twice the quality, which would you choose? Do you know there's some people that would take now? Some might even think that God is slow. But someone who has created such a thing as light speed and who knows what's happening at every part of the universe that's some 93 billion light years across is anything but slow. He's not slow. He has perfect timing. There's something interesting too. And this is in Matthew chapter 10, verse 16. I'm going to read it. So God tells us to be wise as serpents in Matthew chapter 10, verse 16. Of all the animals, why would God use a snake as something that we should be like? You know why? Because a snake, everything with a snake is timing. It waits for that animal, little mouse or whatever, to go by. And if he strikes too soon, he'll lose the kill. A snake has the ability to almost perfect timing of know just when to strike, when it's in the right distance to get a meal. Otherwise, it's going to grow hungry. So God wants us to have the mindset of understanding the right timing is everything in life. The right time is everything. For a serpent, this knowledge is the key to survival. 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8. But beloved, do not forget this one thing, that with the Lord one day is as a thousand years, and a thousand years as one day. The Lord is not slack concerning his promises, as ye some count slackness, but he is longsuffering toward us, that not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. I am very grateful that our God is patient as he is, especially with me. But he is. He set these things in motion, this building project, 6,000 years ago. It was started. Still going, but you know what? It's going to be so much better than having it right away. He has a plan that is absolutely amazing. Why did Yeshua, Jesus, why did he come 2,000 years ago? Why in the midst of the week? Anybody ever thought about that? No. I've wondered that. And the conclusion that I come up with is that it would have to be a time for Messiah to fulfill prophecy. It would have to be at a time when there's a sacrificial system in full swing. And the way in which he would die would be crucified. And so the Romans would have to be in power or a government entity, that everything would fall in line exactly as it was prophesied. Maybe I'm wrong, Norman, but everything had to fall in line according to what was prophesied would happen. I often wonder that. Why didn't Jesus die back in Genesis? Why didn't he die? Why 2,000 years ago?
Because mankind thinks they can do it without him.
Yes. Exactly. Timing. Romans chapter 5, verse 6 says so. For when we were still without strength, in due time, Christ died for the ungodly. It says, in due time, meaning that this time was established by God. It wasn't the Jews that, oh, darn, I sent my son and they just killed him. No, it says that Yeshua, Jesus, was crucified from the foundation of the world, meaning you go all the way back to Genesis. This is all part of his master plan. And it would be anything, as I show up on a job site and this is the new job, I sit down with the super, we lay out the plans, and he explains what the sequence of events is and what is going in first and next and next and next. I wrap my mind around that as a contractor. I get it. It's trust. Trust. I'm going to show you something else too, if I can. Am I running out of time? Anyway, Amos 3:3. Everybody knows this scripture, Amos 3:3. Two cannot walk together unless they be agreed. Okay. For years, I thought, well, that means that, you know, if you're going to be friends with somebody, you need to kind of have the same ideas. And, you know, you can't be real best friends with someone who likes to hunt. And if you don't like to hunt and you're a vegan or whatever, I always thought it meant that they had to be agreed. But that word there, the word agreed is ya'ad. And it means to meet by appointment, to gather or assemble by appointment. Think about that. God has his holy days. There's seven of them. They are purposely in order, a sequence of events, and the timing. So today, during the Feast of Tabernacles, we are meeting him by appointment, his appointment. But it says, two cannot walk together unless they meet by appointment. That's kind of a different take on that, Amos 3:3, isn't it? Look it up. By implication, to meet at a stated time. So none of us here in this room chose when to meet for the Feast of Tabernacles. He did. It's in Leviticus chapter 23. It tells you when, what day of what month? He did. This is the master builder saying, okay, I want you here to do the plumbing and HVAC. I would like to have you here Thursday because I have this guy coming in Monday and I need this all done. And that I can wrap my mind around. It's a sequence of events. This is his timing. He's chosen the meetings. So we need to trust the superintendent. We need to rely and trust his timing. And what he is going to bring about will be done in the proper time, in the proper way. We need to trust in that. That's all I have. Anybody have any comments or questions? Tim?
In Isaiah 64, verse 8. But now, O Lord, you are our Father, we are the clay, and you our potter, and all we are the work of your hand. So mm-hmm. I just think that goes along very well with what you were talking about.
Excellent, yes. Thank you.